This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Today on the show, the children of a group of Indigenous Australians born in PNG face uncertainty over their citizenship status.
We got the visa thinking that like it's already a permanent resident or citizen, something like that. But later on, we found out that no, it's not. It's temporary.
Meanwhile, there's fears economic growth in 11 Pacific countries could grind to a halt, and a new research project in Micronesia uncovers new information from the Second World War. All that and more coming up. I'm your host, Kyle Evans, filling in for Agitupo. Thanks for joining me. But first, Fiji's Women's Minister, Linda Taboia, has been removed from her position as the deputy leader of governing party, the People's Alliance. Ms. Taboia has been at the centre of an alleged sex scandal involving a fellow minister while on an official trip to Australia's State Parliament of Victoria in Melbourne last year. The party, which is led by Prime Minister Sitiveni Rumbuka, made the announcement yesterday after its disciplinary committee investigated the allegations. Joining me now to unpack it all is our Fiji reporter, Lithe Mavono. Bulavanaka, Lithe.
Bula and Yandra to you, Carl. Good to be talking to you.
Likewise. So let's start. What did the party say in removing Linda Taboia?
Kyle, the party's Executive Council met on Monday, and they immediately dispatched as well as emailed the decision to Ms. Taboia before the statement was leaked to the media yesterday morning. But what they have said is that the allegation, the scandal and the allegations around it has brought irreparable damage and disrepute. Those were the exact words they said. Irreparable damage and disrepute to the party's image and reputation. And so right now, what we understand is that the party's executive council has put to the Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rumbuka, who is party leader, of course, to make the decision on what happens next to Ms. Taboia.
Yeah, look, very strong language indeed. Do we know if she'll remain as an MP?
Well, right now, she remains as an MP. It is only the Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rumbuka, who can remove her as a cabinet minister. And right now, it's really unclear whether the party itself has the ability to remove her as MP. Now, Kyle, we have not heard from Ms. Taboia, but it is unlikely that she will resign from the position of Member of Parliament, which is the only other concrete way for her to be removed from Parliament.
You mentioned we hadn't heard from Ms. Taboia, but what's her previous stance been around all this?
Well, we made several requests to reach Ms. Taboia yesterday, phone messages as well as text messages, and she has not responded or picked up our calls. But in the previous time, since these allegations came to light late last year, she implied that these were fake images. The alleged affair came to light when alleged images from a messaging app were leaked to the media. It's our understanding that the phone of sacked Education Minister Asiri Rondrondro was leaked. And so she has implied that those images are fake and that indecent images purported to be of her were also fake.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans and I'm chatting with the ABC's Fiji reporter, Lithe Mavono. We're chatting about Fiji's Women's Minister, Linda Taboia, who has been removed from her position as the deputy leader of Fiji's governing party, the People's Alliance. Now, Lithe, let's look at a broader picture of all this. What's all this likely to mean for the government of Fiji?
Well, right now, there's quite a lot of speculation. But until the Prime Minister makes a decision on Ms. Taboia, there's still quite a lot up in the air. However, what we understand is that when Parliament sits next week, it was formally opened a few days ago, but when it sits next week, there is likely to be moves made by the opposition against the government. They're likely to allege that this shows the instability of the People's Coalition government, government, but quite a lot is quite unclear. What we do know, however, from the decision that the People's Alliance Management Party have decided is that they're lending weight to the allegations. They're lending credibility to the allegations. And the allegations themselves have quite caused an uproar here. It even reached the Australian E-Safety Commission, with Mr. Mbue having made a complaint against one of the websites that was publishing, you know, these purported images of her. And so what we do understand is that now there's a lot of light cast on Prime Minister Rumbuka's ability to hold on to the credibility of his government and his party.
I see a lot at stake, and you're right, the news certainly has travelled. And what are people saying on the ground in Fiji? I mean, what's the mood like in the country? Can you put that into context for us?
Well, there's quite a lot of shock, primarily because the other minister, the two ministers, the sacked education minister, Asire Rendrondo, and Linda Tembuya, had been asked by the prime minister late last year whether the allegations were true. The two of them are told to have denied it, and the prime minister went public with a statement that he accepted the two MPs' stance that, you know, they were not engaged in this affair. Now, this alleged affair is said to have taken place in Melbourne, Kyle, while the two were on a tour of the Victorian Parliament. Now, what we understand is that they are said to have said, no, we did not engage in an affair, and the Prime Minister defended them. So for the party to have gone around and said, we will take action against her, it's lending weight to these allegations. And so there are quite a lot of shocked people. A lot of us thought that this was now behind us, and now all eyes are on the Prime Minister to make decisions that people see as either ruining the credibility of his party and his government or holding on to it.
Yeah, and I guess that answers my last question. I mean, is this the biggest challenge that the government's potentially had to face so far?
Well, that's the thing, Kyle. He's, the Prime Minister has faced quite a few challenges towards the end of last year and early this year, particularly on, you know, on his international position, on the government's foreign policy around the Israeli-Gaza war, on government's stance on China. So the Prime Minister has taken quite a few hits. And so on Linda Tembuya herself, the Prime Minister has also had to deal with quite a lot. Mr. Mbuya had been removed as the leader of government business in the last quarter of last year because of allegations that, you know, she didn't follow proper procedure in Parliament. So, no, this is not the first hit that the Prime Minister is taking, and this is probably not the most serious one, but this is, you know, quite a number have happened before now. And so all eyes will now be on the Prime Minister to take action that protects the reputation of his government or continue to protect Mr. Mbuya, which he has done in the past.
All eyes indeed. It has certainly caused quite a stir. Lithe, that's all we've got time for, but thank you so much for your expert analysis, as always.
Vinaka.
That was the ABC's Fiji reporter, Lithe Mavono. A group of Indigenous Australians who were born in Papua New Guinea say they're living with grave uncertainty. While they've been granted a visa to live in Australia, their children are still stuck overseas. Now they want full citizenship so they can access all the rights they believe they deserve. Marion Farr reports.
Dunda Koigut lives in constant anxiety, worrying about his three children who live overseas.
And I'm trying to sponsor my kids back in Papua New Guinea.
He wants to bring them here to Australia to live with him, but his visa won't allow it.
We got that visa thinking that, like, it's already a permanent resident or citizen, something like that. But later on, we found out that no, it's not, it's temporary.
Mr. Koigut has Torres Strait Islander descent and is recognised as an Indigenous Australian. But because he was born in Papua New Guinea, he doesn't have Australian citizenship. He belongs to a special category of people under Australian law who are referred to as non-alien non-citizens. In 2020, the High Court of Australia ruled that people like Mr. Koigut couldn't be deported. Kim Rubenstein is a lawyer and citizenship expert from the University of Canberra who followed the case closely.
If you don't have a visa, you have to be put in detention for the purposes of removing you. Now, of course, Indigenous Australians can't be removed, therefore they can't be in detention, and therefore they have to have a visa.
Last year, the Australian government granted Mr. Koigat and others in his position a special purpose visa. It means he can work, access Medicare and some financial support, as well as travel to and from Australia. At first, Mr. Koigat was delighted.
I was thinking that I will try to sponsor my kids or girlfriend, something like that.
But now he realises he can't bring his children to live with him.
I can't suffer like this. I want my kids here.
Recently, one of his sons became very sick with malaria and almost died.
He went out of breath for some seconds, yeah.
Mr. Koigat sent money to pay for his medical care.
I mean, I have to send money from here to take him to the hospital. It's very expensive.
The special purpose visa is also temporary, and that's a worry for Mr. Koigat.
If the minister wishes to cancel my visa, they can do it anytime. So I'm scared.
He wants to be recognised as an Australian citizen.
I'm already recognised as a Torres Strait Islander. I should have a citizenship straight away by descent.
Lawyer Kim Rubenstein can see the benefits.
I think that that would be a much more socially cohesive approach to membership for people who the High Court of Australia have identified clearly as being people who have a right to be in Australia.
In total, 16 people have been granted special purpose visas. Australia's Department of Home Affairs says it's committed to working with Indigenous Australians on matters that affect them. A spokesperson said the government intended to provide a pathway to permanent residency for people like Mr. Koigat. For him and his kids, that can't come soon enough.
But like, it's taking too long and I'm worried about them.
Torres Strait Islander Dunda Koigat ending that report by Marion Farr.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sports people to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
A new World Bank report has found that economic growth in the Pacific region has slowed despite an initial burst of growth following the COVID-19 pandemic. And the forecast for the coming year is not so rosy either, with the study into 11 Pacific countries forecasting a decline in economic growth. Joining us now to speak more about this report is Rashika Singh, World Bank Senior Economist and Report Co-author. Rashika, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Kyle. Talofa, and good morning from up here.
Good morning to you. Let's jump right into it. What were the key findings from the report?
Thank you, Kyle. So for this update, I just want to highlight that we have separated the two largest economies in the Pacific region, excluding PNG, that are Fiji and Solomon Islands, and created two groups for the rest of the Pacific Island countries. So the first group is tourism and remittance-led countries, which are Palau, Samoa, Tonga, and Vanuatu. And the second is sovereign rent-led countries, which are the Federated States of Micronesia, the Republic of Marshall Islands, Tuvalu, Kiribati, and Nauru. And the report provides more detail on how these groups were derived. So in terms of the key findings, we see that the growth in Pacific economies decelerated from a strong 9.1% in 2022 to a still robust 5.5% in 2023. And the reduction in growth is due to the group's largest economy, Fiji, moving towards its long-term growth rate after a strong rebound from the pandemic in 2022. So just zooming into Fiji, in 2022, it made an impressive post-pandemic rebound with growth reaching 20%, and tourism and household consumption, including remittances, have been helping growth. And in 2023, growth slowed to 8%, helping Fiji's output surpass its pre-pandemic levels.
I see. So they're still growing, but they're not slowing to a point where there might be a risk of a recession. Is that fair to say?
That is very fair to say. So it's basically they're converging towards their trend growth. And all these, you know, high growth that we have seen in 2022 in Fiji is like a pent-up demand post-border reopening.
Excellent, excellent. So can you outline which countries, I guess, perform the most strongly?
Sure, I can do that. So as I just explained, I mean, Fiji continued to be the strongest performer in 2023, followed very closely by Samoa. As you know, it is also dependent on tourism. And as soon as borders reopen, you know, tourism inflows have been strong, and that has been driving the country, including consumption that has been supported by strong remittance inflows. And this is followed by Palau, Kiribati, and Tonga. And in most cases, border reopening has supported the recovery.
I see. And I guess what separated, the stronger performing countries from the poorer performing nations? Was that just simply size of the economy and big tourism markets and things like that?
Exactly. So there's a lot of idiosyncratic factors explaining the divergences. So as you know, because of the deeper contraction in tourism-dependent countries, that we had expected a strong rebound. So that is what we are seeing in countries like Fiji, Samoa, Palau, Vanuatu, and Tonga. And on the other hand, you know, other countries that are in the second group, the sovereign rent-led groups, they did not see such a sharper contraction, of course, because they did not rely on tourism. So the border closures did not have such a huge impact on these economies. So again, then the recovery, I would say, was smaller relative to this other group.
I see. And what are the predominant reasons for the slowing down of economic decline? Is it similar to what we're seeing in other places around the world in terms of inflation and global conflict and things like that?
So like I mentioned at the beginning, this is basically, so the slowing down, yes, there's many factors coming at play, but I would say it's basically converging towards the long-term trend. So basically, we are going back to where we were pre-pandemic. So all these like 2022, 2023 growth was high and kind of abnormal because of the pent-up demand. And now we are basically converging towards long-term trend growth. But of course, you know, all these global factors, you know, the Pacific is very vulnerable to external shocks. So these uncertainties in the global economic environment, the global economic slowdown, high inflation in our neighboring countries, Australia and New Zealand, could have an impact on the growth trajectory going forward.
I see. And do we have an idea of what kind of impact the labour mobility schemes in these various Pacific economies, what impact that might have had?
Sure. So from our perspective, you know, migration schemes serve as an engine of development and is an increasingly important pillar of bilateral and regional economic relationships. While we acknowledge the challenges associated with labor migration, on balance, it offers significant benefits to those involved, the broader community, and the entire Pacific. So migration, both permanent and temporary, has made an important economic contribution to the Pacific through one, remittances, and two, knowledge sharing. And if I can share some of the statistics, you know, six of the top 10 remittance recipients by share of GDP in the EAP region are in the Pacific, while Tonga and Samoa are often among the top five globally. And, you know, in addition to supporting macroeconomic stability, the foreign exchange earnings that comes with remittances also directly support the livelihoods of many people in the Pacific. And to put this into context, in Tonga and Samoa, four out of every five households receive remittances from abroad. And I must share, Kyle, for a more in-depth analysis, one could refer to our August 2023 edition of the Pacific Economic Update, which had a special focus topic on harnessing the benefits of migration in the Pacific.
Fascinating stuff. You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans and I'm chatting with World Bank Senior Economist Rashika Singh. We're discussing a recent report which highlights economic growth is slowing down slightly in the Pacific. Now, Rashika, economic growth, I understand, is forecast to continue to slow down in 2024 and 2025. What's that going to mean for people on the ground?
Thank you, Carl. That's a good question. So the fact is that the Pacific Island economies have suffered from the COVID-19 pandemic, and the poor and vulnerable were hardest hit. So economic recovery in these Pacific countries will be crucial in supporting poverty reduction efforts. So under current policies, although growth is slowing, these Pacific countries are expected to continue reducing poverty in the next few years. To assess the potential impact, the report conducted simulations considering the latest GDP production projections for five of the Pacific countries, Fiji, Kiribati, Marshall Islands, Tonga, and Vanuatu. And according to these forecasts, all five countries are expected to continue reducing poverty, albeit at varying degrees and paces. The report has more detail on this. Now, I would like to say that materialization of any risks to the outlook that we just talked about on the global front, or any natural disasters or impacts from climate change, this could dent growth further going forward and derail poverty reduction efforts by the Pacific governments. You know, amid this background, the report highlights that one, adaptive social protection systems targeting the poor and most vulnerable would be most effective. And I must say that Fiji, Samoa, and Tonga, with the help of World Bank, have made good progress in this regard. And two, the need to implement structural reforms and building resilience to enhance growth prospects would further assist Pacific governments in addressing poverty-related concerns.
I guess you briefly touched on it, but my next question was going to be, what are the challenges to economic growth going to be going forward? Do you forecast? Will it be natural disasters mainly and things like that?
Thanks, Kyle. Yeah, I mean, of course, I cannot emphasize enough the impact and the vulnerability of the impact of natural disasters and climate change on the Pacific. And in addition, constraints such as human capital, connectivity deficiencies, and inadequate infrastructure hinder economic growth and development in the Pacific as well. And these intrinsic challenges magnify the influence of external factors, including geographical distance from key market, limited economies of scale, etc. And I must say, Kyle, at this point, that despite a commendable rebound in growth post-border reopening, the Pacific countries are simply reverting to their 2019 output levels, which is posing challenges to sustained development.
Go ahead. Does that perhaps speak to the fact that there may be backbone industries, things like tourism, construction, agriculture, that they're not growing at the rate that they might have hoped?
Yes, and I must point at this juncture as well, Kyle, that from the World Bank side, we have country-specific analytical pieces as well, such as our country economic memorandums and systematic country diagnostics, that gives you a more country-specific challenges and recommendations. And like you mentioned, other sectors, like what is happening, in Fiji, Samoa, Palau, Vanuatu, the reliance on tourism, right? So these reports, I think diversification is one of the common themes coming out of our analysis for many Pacific countries. And, experience from COVID amplifies this message even more that we should not put all eggs in one basket. So I guess, diversification would be key going forward.
Excellent. And I suppose to just finish off, I understand that the report has highlighted investment in education being touted as the key to future prosperity in the Pacific. Why is that?
Thank you, Kyle. So, yeah, I mean, the trajectory of accelerated and sustainable growth in Pacific Island countries depends on a workforce that is well-educated and equipped with enhanced skills and capabilities. Now, there is compelling evidence that a more educated workforce can substantially contribute to accelerated and sustainable growth through heightened employability, increased economic mobility, and enhanced resilience to shocks. Boosting education and skills is essential for long-term growth and poverty reduction in the Pacific. More education and improved skills, as highlighted in the report, will help people prepare for more productive jobs, either domestically or internationally. innovate more and be more resilient. And for many people living in poverty, education is their most valuable asset. And Kyle, I would also like to highlight that the report underscores the need to implement structural reforms to help tackle obstacles to the key drivers of growth, thereby encouraging job creation and investment. We have talked about low trend growth in the Pacific Island countries. So in order to improve growth prospects, the report highlights the need to, you know, improving productivity. This would mean improving the business environment, innovation, regulatory environment, etc., building quality infrastructure that is resilient to climate change. And the third one is improving the quality and quantity of labor force. How? Among others, such as investments in health and effective social protection systems, investment in education and skills is absolutely crucial.
So whether it's tertiary education or a simple trade, both are just as important as another. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. I guess every country in the Pacific has different challenges. So for some, the issues are at the primary level. For some, it's in the secondary or tertiary. So I guess the recommendations would be different. But in general, if you are investing in the people, in building human capital, that would be crucial to support growth going forward, among others.
And just lastly, I wanted to touch on Fiji's debt, public debt, which is around 83% at the moment. Is this a concern for the World Bank?
Thank you, Kyle. So yes, indeed, Fiji's debt levels are high. In fact, the highest in the region. And the World Bank is concerned about this. Why? This leaves the country with limited buffers to address future shocks. So when I say buffers, it is...
Well, we appeared to have lost Rashika for a second there. If you're just tuning in, it's been a fascinating chat so far. We've actually been, it doesn't seem like the most interesting topic at first when you think economics, but it is a very important one. And it turns out the Pacific region has slowed down. Despite initial bursts of growth back in after the COVID pandemic, we've been talking to World Bank senior economist. She's a co-author of that report. It's Rashika Singh. We lost her a second ago, but I understand she's back now. Rashika, are you there?
I'm here, Kyle. Can you hear me?
I can.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. We were discussing Fiji's public debt, which is around 83%. Would you like to continue?
Thank you, Kyle. Yeah, so as I mentioned, yes, the World Bank is concerned about this. And the reason is that, you know, high debt level leaves the country with limited buffers to address future shocks. And I was going into explain, you know, what a fiscal buffer is. It is like a financial safety net for a government. Just like you and I might save some money for unexpected expenses, governments can build up fiscal buffers during good economic times to help them deal with challenges. Now, high debt levels, if remain unchecked, are likely to threaten the country's growth potential going forward, macrofiscal stability, and sustainable economic development amid current fragile global condition. And I must also emphasize that high public debt also comes at a cost of increased debt servicing, which can strain the government's budget and potentially lead to crowding out of other productive spending. This can have a negative impact on economic stability and growth. Nonetheless, Kyle, we welcome the government's fiscal consolidation efforts to reduce the high level of public debt. And fiscal consolidation is like taking steps to reduce our household deficit. It is what governments do to manage their budget and reduce their debt. Now, Fiji has been undertaking revenue-based fiscal consolidation, which help bring down public debt from 86% of GDP in 2022 to 83% of GDP in 2023. However, this is not enough and more work is needed. And the World Bank's public expenditure review in 2023 provides an in-depth analysis on some potential reform options that could assist in this regard.
It's definitely a challenge that the government is going to have to keep an eye on going forward. Rashika, that's all we've got time for today, but thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure, Kyle.
Likewise. That was World Bank senior economist Rashika Singh. Well, it's that time of the morning where we're going to jet set around the Pacific to take a look at what's making headlines around the region. And to do that, I'm joined once again by producer Mackenzie Smith. Mackenzie, how are you this morning?
Yeah, doing good, Kyle. Good to be here.
That's good to hear. And another thing that's good to hear, I'm reading it right now, critical funding for the US allies in the Pacific has again gone before Congress.
Yeah, so there's been months of delays for this funding, which is part of the compacts of free association agreements that the US holds with the Marshall Islands, Palau, and the Federated States of Micronesia. So how those work is they guarantee economic assistance and visa-free access to the US in exchange for exclusive military access to those countries' territories. The US has yet to pass the funding packages that it agreed to in 2023, but Benar News reports that a bill published on Sunday in the House of Representatives to fund the US government also includes funding for the compact agreements. Palau's president, Surangal Whips Jr., says he's heartened by the result.
No, I can only imagine. I'm sure some of those other Micronesian countries will be heartened by that news as well. Meanwhile, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has issued a statement on the US nuclear testing legacy in the Pacific. What have they said?
Yeah, so some of that funding I just mentioned for the compact agreements is also slated for recovery from the US nuclear testing program, particularly for the Marshall Islands, where 67 tests were carried out. So marking the International Day for Disarmament and Non-Proliferation yesterday, the High Commissioner for Human Rights says nuclear radiation and contamination from those tests continues to have an adverse impact on the human rights of the people of the Marshall Islands, including by limiting their access to clean water and a safe environment. The statement says that states have a responsibility to provide mechanisms for truth, accountability, and reparation for the nuclear testing legacy.
And just lastly, in the Cook Islands, the government is reacting to new figures which place it as having the worst childhood obesity rates in the world. Is that right?
Yeah, this follows a recent study in the Lancet Journal which found global increases in obesity, and we're going to hear more about that soon. But the study also placed the Cook Islands, along with Niue, as having the highest childhood obesity rate at more than 30% of children. The Cook Island News reports the Secretary of the Ministry of Health, Bob Williams, saying he's concerned by the statistics, which he says is driven in part by an increase in inactivity and smoking and vaping among children. Williams says he's working with the Education Ministry to improve access to healthy food at schools.
Well, like you said, it very much foreshadows a story we have coming up next. Mackenzie, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWrap this morning.
No worries.
That was producer Mackenzie Smith.
Are you wanting to break your betel nut addiction, zumba your way to a fitter you, or get on top of that excruciating case of gout? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has you covered. Pacific Pulse seeks out experts, movers and shakers, and aunties and uncles from across our region to bust open our health issues, challenge taboos, and separate fact from fiction. Join host Melissa Macon on Pacific Pulse Wednesday at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, more than a billion people now live with obesity, and 9 out of 10 countries with the highest levels of overweight people are in the Pacific region, according to new data published in a prestigious medical journal. Looking at data from 2022, the Lancet study has found obesity among adults has more than doubled since 1990 and has quadrupled among children and adolescents. The World Health Organization has contributed to the data collection, and its representative to the South Pacific, Dr. Mark Jacobs, told Dubravka Volodare the findings are concerning.
Obesity and overweight has been quite a long-term issue in the Pacific, particularly in adults, and it's an increasing issue for children. If we look at the data, then the most recent data that's come at us from 2022, So if you look, for instance, at children and adolescents, so for this it's 5 to 19 years, most of the top 10 countries in the world for the prevalence of children and adolescents with obesity are in the Pacific. So the highest prevalence ones for girls are Niue, Cook Islands, Tonga. The highest ones for boys and adolescents are Niue, Cook Islands. And then if we look at adults, for women, first eight are all in the Pacific in terms of prevalence of obesity. So Tonga, American Samoa, Tokelau be the highest four. And then for men, the highest top nine are all in the Pacific, and the top few are American Samoa, Nauru, Tokelau, and the Cook Islands.
Do you think this is a wake-up call?
Well, I think it's a reminder, but it's actually probably a reminder that the health sector didn't really need, because it's people working in health in the Pacific, actually like many other countries around the world, we see every day the health impacts of people being overweight and particularly obese. And health professionals and health leaders in the Pacific have been concerned about obesity and more broadly around what we call non-communicable diseases for a long time. But what we are seeing this time around is that there's actually also now a worrying trend in children and adolescents. And so if we look at the rates of increase around the world, it's not just adults in the Pacific where there's high rates of obesity and overweight. Now we're seeing a rapid increase in obesity and overweight in girls and boys as well. So it's certainly very concerning. And one thing that these figures tell us, if we keep doing what we've always done, nothing will change. We need to tackle this issue in different ways.
And what do you think can this be attributed to, that there is such concerning data now about children?
There's a number of different things that underlie it. And what we do know, and there's still more that we need to learn around the world around what actually really works to tackle prevalence of obesity in a population. But we know what doesn't work is lecturing people to eat better and exercise more. For instance, in the Pacific, for many families, many communities, and particularly with the growing impact of climate change, it's actually harder and harder to get enough affordable, healthy fresh fruit and vegetables, for instance, because there's more and more impacts on the ability of many of the countries to actually grow enough healthy foods. And so if it's very difficult for people to access affordable fresh fruit and vegetables, it's going to be very difficult to really work with families, work with communities, change their behaviour and to increase the amount of fresh fruit and vegetables that are being eaten. And so whilst it might not be the first thing that people think about the impacts of climate change on health, the fact that there's more and more droughts, there's more and more seawater intrusions into areas that where crops could previously be grown in the Pacific means actually it is a very real climate change health impact. There's more and more reliance on imported foods, and a lot of those, although are less expensive, they're quite energy dense. With families more and more relying on those sort of foods, it makes it harder and harder to avoid overweight and obesity. There's lots of things that are behind it.
Now, we do have sugar and food taxes in many Pacific countries. Do you think this is successful to some degree? Will we see some effects later on, perhaps? Or do you think more needs to be done?
That is one of the actions that is useful, but it will not be enough. There's lots of other actions that are needed. So yes, there's more action needed to try to make healthy foods more attractive and less healthy foods less attractive. And part of that is around the potential for taxing less healthy foods. But we also need to think, with the countries, with the communities, about how do we actually make the healthy foods more available, including cheaper. We do need to really make it easier for families and for communities to have healthy diets in a sustainable way.
And where to from here?
There's actions that individual families can take, and I think a lot of people already understand basically what they are. It's look for opportunities to exercise a bit more, to look at how much they and their families are eating in terms of portion size, but also try to increase the amount of fresh fruit and vegetables, decrease the amount of processed foods that are high in fat, high in sugar. They're the familiar messages for all of us. But, you know, that's not to say that those messages are not important. Clearly they are. And where families have got the ability to make those sort of changes in an affordable way and a sustainable way, then great. But the other sorts of actions are really more at the government and at population level. And a lot of those are around actually really looking seriously about what's underlying obesity and actually taking meaningful action, and governments really looking at this and where they can actually reporting to their communities about what actions they're taking across sectors.
WHO representative to the South Pacific, Dr. Mark Jacobs, talking to Dubravka Volodare. The researchers involved in the study used the body mass index, or BMI, as measurement. They acknowledge it's not a perfect measurement of the extent of body fat, but it's the most widely used, making this analysis possible. Well, the Pacific served as one of the biggest battlegrounds of the Second World War. But amid the chaos, many stories from the conflict have been lost to history. Among them is the little-known chapter of Micronesia's Chuuk Lagoon. The once significant military base is home to dozens of shipwrecks, which now serve as a major attraction for tourists. But now, a team of researchers are attempting to expand the historical narrative beyond the underwater wreckages. Dr. William Jeffrey is heading up the project. He's an Associate Professor of Archaeology and Micronesian Studies at the University of Guam, and he joins us on the line now. Welcome to you, Dr. Jeffrey.
Good morning. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, I guess just firstly, tell us a little bit about how the project came about and what it aims to achieve.
It's an American battlefield protection program through the U.S. National Park Service. I've been working in Chuuk since actually 2001, and I just wanted to keep in touch with them and to keep helping them. We know of the shipwrecks. We know of the 50-plus shipwrecks, the world's best shipwrecks to dive, people say, but we don't know much about what's on land. And yet it was a major base. It was an Imperial Japanese Navy base for 2 years during the war. And there are many things on the big one of the main islands called Tonawos. And so I'm working with the mayor and the community there about documenting them and to further the sort of information there for locals to recognize that the sites, the Japanese sites that there, but the traditional indigenous sites were impacted by the war and that they're not left out of this. So it's a sort of a holistic connection between the land sites and the traditional indigenous sites and the shipwrecks that a big aim of the project is to document them and to interpret them.
Fantastic. So, yeah, look, you just mentioned it was once a Japanese military base. It now houses many shipwrecks. So what kind of things have you unearthed during this project?
We've concentrated on the sites on Tonawos. That was the headquarters for the Japanese, called Nakashima then, and it had 1,200 military buildings on only a very small island. But we've been working with the mayor, as I said, and just revealing different sites and revealing the histories, the connections that the local people have with those sites. That's been really the thing that we're trying to get out. So just working with them. And we also have three new shipwrecks that are very small, not the big shipwrecks like the others, but my research years ago, I found some information about them. So we want to go and search for those. Many of the shipwrecks are dived, and there are great artificial reefs. They're looking at putting World Heritage listing on those. So these three new shipwrecks haven't been dived and haven't had interference. So we want to look at what's there and compare them with what we see on the other shipwrecks.
So you mentioned some of those indigenous land sites that were impacted by the war. What kind of sites were they in, and how were they impacted?
Well, over 6,000-7,000 tons of bombs were dropped on Chuuk, and a lot of them on this island called Tonawos and the nearby island called Eton. So all the traditional sites could be just like in Australia, you know, Dreamtime. It can be hills, it can be streams, they can be just rocks. The bombing, unintentionally damaged those. So and people were moved off this island. so that they couldn't access those sites. As again, just like Aboriginal people that like to go to those sites and reconnect with those sites, they were pushed away from that island, many of them, and couldn't connect with them. So we're wanting to talk to people about those connections. They've been marginalised for many years. People go there and look at Japanese or Australian, I mean American, but don't worry about these sites. So that's our connection. That's our aim, to reconnect with those.
Fantastic. And what's the feedback been from locals who you've spoken to about these things you've found? And I guess just secondly, what was it like for you yourself to uncover, you know, some of these ancient places?
Well, it's fantastic. I started working there in 2001, and I work with traditional chiefs, and many of them have passed away, unfortunately. But with the traditional chiefs there now, so we're working with the sort of newer generation of traditional chiefs, and just reconnecting with them. During COVID, the place shut down. It's a tourist haven, mostly to do with the shipwrecks. So many people didn't go there on the shipwrecks, and they didn't get to the islands. And so people sort of suffered, you know, their economy suffered. So we want to revive that. We want to help the local people revive this sort of connection with tourism, so tourists benefit, but locals benefit from it too. And we want to, you know, people to see that there's a holistic heritage. It's not just the shipwrecks, it's not the land sites, but it's traditional indigenous sites too. That's a big aim of us. So we also want to try and connect with younger people. And we've been talking and working with younger people in different agencies and groups to get them involved in diving, especially young girls, women, because there's not many of them, and people are keen there to do that. So it's good. We think, you know, we're striving, and we will get there in the end with young people to get more involved.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, you've mentioned plans to create a bit of a tourist aspect to these sites. Well, yeah, what kind of vision did you have in mind? Is it around things like installing, you know, local tour guides to sort of take people around and teach them the history of the places and things like that?
Yes, we'll put signs there. Pardon me. Put signs there. We'll put a lot of stuff on the internet. Soft power and you know, the technology is very much evident there as anywhere else in the world. So we're wanting to put like a story map of all the sites of this island on there. We have, I think, about 160 sites that we'll put on a story map. We'll put together a brochure or a sort of foldable poster type brochure accompanied with the signs, and we'll help local people and the mayor of Tonawa Skradvin, ASIC, sort of look at what sort of issues are good for, because we don't just get American or Australian, we get Japanese tourists and other sort of tourists, so we want to look at different ways that we can help connect with those different tourists, with local people, yeah, especially on Tonawa. But we hope this is a stimulus for the other islands in the lagoon. They all have military remains, but Tonawa we started with because it was the headquarters. So we hoped it's a stimulus for these other islands.
Yeah, and look, and just lastly, Bill, because we've only got about 20 seconds to go, but what's next in the project, and do we have a timeline on when you'd like to get these things up and running?
So we'll work until the end of the year, and we hope that, as I said, we hope we other people in the community want to get involved and want to see that we'll do stuff, similar sorts of activities on the other islands. There's 16, 18 high volcanic islands in the lagoon, many military remains there.
That's fantastic, Bill, and all the best with that. We've got to go. That's all we've got time for from Pacific Beat. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. Stay tuned, though, because the news is next, followed by Nisha Daily. I've been your host, Kyle Evans. Thank you very much for joining us.